Hello, and welcome to Season 3 of Medical Women Talking. I'm Jane Dacre, and in this season, I wanted to speak to more wonderful and inspiring medical women, including people who are early and mid-career. These women are all making a name for themselves in their respective fields. They're what I like to call rising stars and will be influencing all our futures.
Chelsea Jewett is an emergency medicine registrar, and she's a co-founder of Surviving in Scrubs, which you'll hear a little bit more about later. So Chelsea, welcome and thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So Chelsea, tell me about your career. When did you first decide you were going to be a doctor?
I'm one of those people that has always said that they wanted to be a doctor since probably about, I was a weird six-year-old. I think I told my parents at six that I was going to go to university and become a doctor. I didn't admit this in my med school interview, but my mum and dad used to always watch Casualty on a Saturday. And I think that's what kind of made me realise that, you know, you could be a doctor, that you know, that was possible. And then, you know, as I grew up, you know, I was a smart kid. I was clever. I really enjoyed science. I really enjoyed biology. I really, really enjoyed chemistry, actually, as well. And I just found the human body fascinating. So as I like then grew up, I then actually realized, oh, no, this actually would be sensible for me. I like the science behind it. I like the problem solving aspects of it. And I really like people. I find people really interesting. So I kind of went through pretty much all of school just determined to get into med school. And then I applied and didn't get in. The first year.
After all
yeah,
that.
No, I know. That was... that year, I also failed my driving test. So I'd been one of those kids that had always like excelled in school, done really well with grades. And then I got to like the age of like 17, 18 and just had two big failures, didn't get into uni and couldn't drive. So had a bit of a meltdown. But then, you know, picked myself up, got my grades in my A-levels and then reapplied and then was lucky enough to get four interviews and to get four offers. So that year I kind of had a bit of a boost and decided to go to Liverpool. And I've been in Merseyside ever since.
And are you the first person in your family to be medical? Have you got medical ancestry of any kind?
Oh, no. Yes, I'm the first medic. I'm definitely the first one to get A-levels. I think I'm potentially the first one to get GCSEs. Don't get me wrong, my mum and dad are very successful. My mum is a hairdresser and is now owns a successful business. And my dad was in the forces, worked his way up as an aeronautical engineer. So they're both very clever, but not necessarily academic. So when it came to me applying to uni and going to uni, they were extremely supportive, very, very proud, but didn't really know what it entailed, particularly when it came to me actually applying and, you know, trying to go through the UCAS application and things. But yeah, no medics, no real academic people, other than myself and then my brother. He went to university as well. He's not medical either. We get on very well, but he's completely different to me. He did communications and now works in PR for a TV company. So really
fantastic.
Interesting, but nothing like me.
might be able to help you with your Surviving in Scrubs publicity, perhaps.
He's given a bit of advice here and there. Yeah.
No, that's great. So, how did you find medical school when you got there?
I think, in all honesty, I think I really struggled in my first year. I'd not necessarily been away from home. I'd had a gap year and I'd been traveling. So I actually, the being away from home thing was fine. It was the trying to fit in with everyone else thing. I partied a bit too hard in my first year. And, you know, I was in med school now, so things were difficult. So I scraped my first year exams, and kind of found it a bit bumpy trying to make friends, particularly because I had to have a part-time job as well in order to afford to, you know, pay my rent and eat. So so I found my first year quite tricky. But I actually met one of my closest and best friends on my first day of university. And she's completely different to me. She's very sensible, got her head switched on. So then after having that kind of wake up call of, oh no, I've actually got to buckle down and do some work here now. From my second year onwards, I think I enjoyed it more because I'd found a really good friend and then a few more very close good friends following that. I'd started studying. I sort of got my time management a bit better so that my studies weren't affected by my work, my part-time jobs, etc. And then I started going on to placement, and then that's when it all kind of came, all kind of like seemed a bit more worthwhile. I sort of got it a bit more. Whereas when it was all just textbooks and cadavers, I didn't really love it that much. Mm-hmm. But then when it came to clinical medicine, I really enjoyed it. And then my exam results absolutely mirrored the fact that I was enjoying it, because that and the fact I was actually working again and studying again. So towards the end of my 5 years, I'd brought myself up to I think the third decile in my year group, and you know, was getting pretty good marks and got to the point where I was starting to enjoy it. I was ready to start work, don't get me wrong. I was fed up of being skint, but I did eventually enjoy it. Yeah.
Fantastic. So you talked about casualty early on. Is that why you decided to stick in there and do emergency medicine, or were there other influences?
So I didn't. When I went to med school, I wanted to be a GP. And all the way through med school, I wanted to be a GP. I had it in my head about, you know, continuity of care, being a part of a community. I'm a generalist. I like a little bit of everything. And I thought, yeah, general practice is definitely the one for me. And then I got to my F2 year and did a GP job. And I absolutely hated it. I hated it.
Why did you hate it?
Do you know, I was so lonely. I was like so lonely. I think the practice I was in was particularly isolated. There were dynamics in that practice which definitely made me feel as though people didn't really get on. I wasn't supported as a trainee at all. And it just really, it's a shame because it just really put me off that specialty. And if it hadn't have put me off that specialty, I'd be a GP by now. And I wouldn't be a perpetual trainee. So that was my first job in F2. I then went on to a psych job, absolutely not for me. And then my final job in F2 was emergency medicine. And I absolutely fell in love with it. Again, you get a little bit of everything. So very general, not specific to one particular organ system. Cradle to grave, you can see peds, you can see the elderly, you can see everyone in between. Surgical, medical, psych, all the specialty. I just loved it. I loved that you didn't know what was coming in. And I still do. I love that you've got an undifferentiated patient. And to me, it's what I went to med school for, because you see a patient, you take a history, you examine, you do some investigations, you make a diagnosis, you make a plan. And then there's someone else's problem. You know, then you refer on and you can start again. I've got a very short, you know, I'm a very typical emergency medic. I've got a fairly short attention span. I need to be constantly stimulated. I like practical procedures. So that's when I fell in love with it.
But you hear all sorts of horror stories about what it's like in A&E departments now.
It took me a while to decide on emergency medicine. So I did my foundation years and then I did an F3, 4, 5. within which time I was trying to convince myself to do emergency medicine. The department that I did my foundation year in had no female consultants, had no female registrars, and had two ST1s who were doing the ACCS training who were female. So I didn't have much in terms of role modelling at that point. So I went off and did a trust grade job, more local to where I lived, at the Royal Liverpool Hospital. And that's more of a 50-50 split. And that's when I thought, oh yeah, no, I definitely could do, I could do emergency medicine. But I'd had a lot of people telling me, oh, should you, if you like all these things, do anaesthetics, do anaesthetics. So then I did an ICM job for a year, which didn't make me
intensive care.
Intensive care medicine, yeah, which didn't make me like anaesthetics, but made me love intensive care medicine. So I'm now in a situation where I've just put my application in for intensive care medicine as well.
Oh wow, so you're going to swap from emergency medicine to intensive care?
No, I'm hoping to dual a credit.
Okay.
So I'm a perpetual trainee. I'm going to be a trainee until I'm at least 45, I think. Fine, it's all about the journey, isn't it? And then so then at that point I was actually, yeah, I'll do emergency medicine. But I got engaged. My now husband proposed to me, so I was like, oh, do you know what, I'm gonna have another year of locuming and traveling and having a nice chunk of time off for my wedding. But that didn't happen because COVID hit. So then I went into training, and that's why I'm here. And I know you've got corridor medicine and things, but it's still, to me, it's still just the best specialty ever.
Fantastic to hear that, because we
there's
don't
there's got to be people crazy enough to do it, hasn't there? Because
well,
there no
clearly are. There clearly are. So what made you get interested in setting up Surviving in Scrubs?
Yeah, so my own experiences. I've already kind of touched on how I was kind of pushed in different directions to where I've now ended up. So I was pushed towards general practice because it's female friendly. and I'd had a lot of experiences it's all come to me in hindsight. So I had a particular episode. I won't go into the details, but I was basically humiliated in a very gendered manner. And following on from that,
at work, at work.
Yeah, so it was at work. A consultant humiliated me in front of essentially an MDT, and I'd. At the time I was reading Laura Bates's book, Everyday Sexism. And it was just like my eureka moment, like, oh my God, I've just experienced sexism at work. And then I started talking to my colleagues, both at my grade and more senior, because then I was like, oh, this will just be something that happens in training. It'll stop when I become a consultant. Naive, obviously. Started talking to consultants and they're like, oh no, I always get talked over in meetings. Oh no, you know, people always assume I'm the SHO because I'm female. And I was like, oh my God. So off the back of that, I did some work myself, just a Survey Monkey rubbish little survey that I shared on social media, got about 100 responses, and then presented to the BMA and Medical Women's Federation conference. That then got picked up by the BMA and resulted in the Sexism in Medicine survey and report that they published in August 21. And then that's when Becky, Dr. Becky Cox, the other half of the operation, got in contact with me. And then we started thinking, well, what could we do? And that's where Surviving in Scrubs came from. But
you didn't know each other before.
No. Becky got in touch with me through that BMA work. And it was all still sort of lockdown, not lockdown. So we spoke on Zoom quite a few times and then eventually met in person. had a bottle of wine in a semi-dodgy pub in Birmingham, and then Surviving in Scrubs was formed. And, you know, we've not looked back ever since. And we are very lucky that we get on so well and that we've got such a good working relationship, but also a very supportive relationship as well. We've really, really lucked out that we've found each other, really.
Fantastic. So tell us a little bit about Surviving in Scrubs. How does it work?
Yeah, so we are a campaign organisation. We've been going for probably about just shy of 18 months now. And at our core, we are a website, survivinginscrubs.co.uk, where anyone in healthcare, be they doctors, nurses, physios, OTs, admin staff, whoever, wherever in the country, can anonymously submit their stories, their testimonies of sexism, misogyny, sexual harassment, and sexual assault within the healthcare workplace. And we have, I think we're on 203 stories on there now. Some are a couple of sentences, some of them are paragraphs and paragraphs long. And that collective narrative has enabled myself and Becky to go and knock on some pretty influential doors, get into some pretty influential meetings with the likes of NHS England, Education for Scotland, NHS Wales. We've been to the BMA, we've been to the GMC, Royal Colleges, all over really, mainly to say, look at this problem. What are you going to do about it? And that's kind of what we do now is we educate, we do training, and we just advocate for survivors of these behaviours and these issues.
So the emergency medicine physician has made a diagnosis, has identified the problem and is handing on to someone else, or are you going to hang on in?
nice. I like that. So we have a series of recommendations that we give to organisations. We are more than happy to work alongside and are working alongside a lot of these organisations to bring about change. Also trust level as well. A big part of what we do is education and training. And that's another part of my career that I'm a very keen educationalist. I'm actually, I've had to pause it because I'm currently on maternity leave, but I'm actually doing the health professions masters at UCL. I'm a very keen educationalist. We do a lot of training. We go into organisations and offer training modules to not only highlight these issues, but, you know, try and put some training into regarding bystanding and speaking up and what supervisors and managers can do, etc. So we are we are trying to treat the problem, but we are very aware that we do have limitations. You know, it's Becky and I predominantly doing this. We do have some volunteers behind us supporting us, but Becky and I both work and we are doing this in our own free time, so yeah. it's trying to balance things, really.
Is it too much to ask you to just give us a flavour of some of the stories that you've got on the website?
Yeah, no, there's just a real variety. So we've got, we have a lot from surgeons and from medical students within surgical placements. A lot of inappropriate touching whilst being scrubbed in. So being scrubbed in means you're completely defenceless. You can't break that sterile field. And there is a particular story of a medical student who scrubbed into theatre, who's got the consultant supervisor right next to them who isn't scrubbed, with their hand on her waist during the whole operation. And that's a story that I include in most, if not all, of the talks that I do, because I think that just demonstrates so much of what the problem is. You know, it's happening in theatres, at the operating table. So you know that there are people around, there's a team around who haven't spoken up, that don't feel they're able to speak up. So there's that culture of tolerance that I think that is absolutely endemic throughout the whole of healthcare, and one of the big reasons why, you know, sexism, misogyny, etc., is existing within this workspace. The fact that the survivor of this story is a medical student, so that shows the power dynamic and how that plays into these issues as well. And the fact that, you know, how is a medical student meant to speak up? We know that the reporting processes just aren't there, and medical students are very at risk of these issues because they are lower down in the medical hierarchy. But also when they're on clinical placement, there's kind of a balance of the ownership of who deals with that. Is it the trust or is it the university? And, you know, all of these issues are issues that we are not only highlighting, but that we are talking with trusts and universities about. So Becky and I went and talked to the Medical Schools Council a couple of weeks ago about all this. So there's lots and lots and lots of work to be done.
Fantastic. Yeah. I mean, it is a fantastic piece of work. And you're right. You know, people of my generation just thought that that was what happened to female medical students, and we just learnt to put up with it. But looking back now, it absolutely wasn't right. So has being involved in Surviving in Scrubs impacted your career positively or negatively, or does it change the way people look at you?
Yeah, it has. I definitely get thought of as the angry feminist quite a lot. and I've actually had people call me that to my face, which initially I used to get quite angry about and frustrated with. But actually, do you know what? They're bob on. I am a feminist and I'm pretty angry about the situation. So I've taken the power away from those words now.
Well done.
Has it affected my career? I've been on maternity leave for the past 9-10 months, so I've kind of stepped out of the career, the clinical career zone, for a little while. So when I go back in February, I think that's probably when I'll find out how.
When you'll find out. Things. What about personal relationships? Family, husband, baby.
My husband is very, very proud of me. Bless him. He's nominated me for like a local award, so the Merseyside Women of the Year award. I didn't win, but he nominates me. He himself is a sports journalist, and he's got quite a decent social media following. So he tweets and retweets all the things that we do. In terms of baby, well, she doesn't know any different because she's been around as long as the campaign has. I think the week we launched was the week I found out I was pregnant with her. So she's been there from day one, but she comes with me everywhere. My mum is also my biggest cheerleader. We have a laugh because she's my roadie. She comes and when we've got sessions where I can't juggle baby in a talk. So she's, you know, my daughter's just shy of 9 months, but she's everywhere now. She's crawling and she's a woman who knows her own voice.
Good for her. What a lovely thing to hear. So, and what about advice to young women coming through who listen to this podcast?
Just do it. Just do whatever you want to do. And we didn't know what we were doing when we started off. We've never made a website. I don't know how we got the audacity to just write an open letter to the GMC, but we did it and we're still standing. Just give it a go. Don't get me wrong, it's not been an easy road. It's been quite bumpy. There's been a lot of imposter syndrome. There's been a lot of paranoia about what's going to happen to our career, etc. But actually, we're fine. We're still standing. We are professional troublemakers now, but what is it? Well-behaved women rarely make history, or something.
Absolutely.
Along those lines, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So just give it a go would be my advice.
That's excellent. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today, and we'll be watching you and also watching your co-lead Becky Cox to see how it all goes, and I suspect we'll all continue to be very grateful to you. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Medical Women Talking with me, Jane Dacre. If you wish to hear more conversations with medical women, then check out the other seasons of this podcast series. And thank you for listening.